Welcome to AZMcast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the referenced paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the October episode of AZMcast. Now, if you dozed off during last month's episode on introduction to procedural sedation, well, good. Maybe we should use this podcast instead of pharmaceuticals. At least then, the only side effects you'd have to worry about would be intractable vomiting, maybe bleeding from your ears, and, well, boredom. So I guess not really that much safer than what we do right now. Well, this month we talk about safety with procedural sedation. Now, anyone can put a patient to sleep, and if that's all sedation was, then we would just be glorified drug dealers. No, the trick is to put them to sleep, keep them asleep during the painful or uncomfortable parts of the patient's care, and then wake them back up without any side effects. It's the medicine version of pulling the tablecloth without spilling the dishes, and that's why we get paid the big bucks. So how do we do this safely? How do we balance giving enough medication to keep the patient comfortable while not putting them so deep that they suffer apnea or hypotension, or they sleep for the next 4 hours in your ED bed while they take up a nurse? I promise we'll cover all these things, and we'll get to the drugs soon. But if you can't do procedural sedation safely, then you probably won't get to do it again. So start your Q5-minute vital signs in preparation for this month's episode of AZMcast.
I think there's a couple of really interesting points in that. One is the safety of kind of the process now. And I think a lot of it is that we prepare for these, right? We know what sort of monitoring we should have in place. And it's debatable about, you know, the extent of monitoring that's necessary. But we have procedures in place for, you know, having someone who's solely dedicated to managing the sedation, somebody who's watching the vitals while another person's doing the procedures. We have practices in place to make sure that we have airway equipment at the bedside, fluids hanging so that if they experience hemodynamic instability, we can correct that. And all of those things, I think, help to make a much safer environment. In addition to the safer drugs that we're using. So when I first started 10 years ago, we still had chloral hydrate around. Nobody used it, but I mean, this stuff was initially invented in like 1850 and then was used to knock people out and rob them in the bars in Chicago Southside, like the Mickey Finn, like
the ether
it's still being used. There's a lot of stuff in Chicago.
That's true. But yeah, I mean, you know, the agents that we use, you know, with any regularity now are so much safer than some of the stuff that was used in the past. Methohexital is another one. Just that, we used it a little bit when there was a propofol shortage, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And I was excited at first. I'm like, ooh, cool, new toy, something to try. And but the interpatient variability in dosing and response was crazy. You'd have one patient who would respond to a half a mg per kg, and another patient would need six. And you just ended up, you know, you really couldn't predict it. Whereas things like ketamine, propofol, the things we use pretty routinely now, I have a pretty good sense for what a mg per kg is going to do.
And so there's ASEP put out a clinical policy in 2014 about procedural sedation and analgesia in the emergency department. And a couple of the things that they came up with, one of the greatest things was that they said there's really no evidence basis for having a patient be fasted for any amount of time in the ED. Now, I think you could argue that if the patient is actively vomiting up a greasy cheeseburger, maybe maybe let that settle, you know?
Give him some Zofran.
But, you know, fasting for anesthesia, oh, man, hospitals have these clear-cut rules. They must be, you know, such and such. 2 hours for clears, but somehow breast milk is a clear, but formula is not a clear. And 8 hours for any kind of solids or anything else like that. So these are the rules that they have set, and these rules are to safeguard patients. So as much as I want to scoff at it, it is to safeguard patients. But I also can't keep a patient in the ED for 8 hours until they're fasted. And so the ACEP 2014 clinical policy says there's really no benefit to waiting for patients to fast. You don't need to wait to do an ED procedural sedation. Very helpful. And for those of you that are in residency right now, you're like, well, duh. But this was not a duh in the early 2000s. This was a each hospital had its own rules of what you could or could not do. And if you had any kind of bad outcome, they would look to see how long they were fasted. I'll make a little side comment real quick of there's not a lot that we can do in the emergency department to cancel an emergency of like anesthesia can say, hey, patient ate 7 hours and 58 minutes ago. I'm going to have to cancel this procedure. You know, you're going to have to get your elective cholecystectomy next week or something. You know, airplane pilots can cancel flights. Like, we don't get to cancel stuff much, but we can cancel this. And I have, on many occasions, canceled a procedural sedation, much to the disappointment of the orthopedist or the ophthalmologist or the plastic surgeon or whoever was down there, because, you know what? Somebody sicker came in. And this is probably one of the more elective things that we choose to do. And I think because you can cancel this procedure, you should have that in mind of, do I actually need to do this procedure right now? Is it convenience? Is it the best thing for the patient? Or is there somebody else that can do this better? But I've had several times where I'm getting ready to start a sedation and I get a page that we've got a unconscious, unresponsive 3-year-old coming in, and I go, nope, we're not doing it. I got to go. And I just leave. We're not pushing any drugs. We're not doing anything else. And it is one of the few things that you actually have under your control to cancel in the ED. And if your subspecialist or whoever it is doesn't like that, then they can try to arrange it with anesthesia. But we've got to triage patients when they come in.
Yeah, the fasting time. I practiced when we had to document it. You had to wait. You know, we'd write it down, and someone would, oh, is it time yet? Well, we got 30 minutes, and you got it. You know, it was obnoxious. And at the time, there really wasn't good literature for it either. Nor was there good experience, because there's trauma patients who would eat pizza and then they'd get, you know, to the operating room within an hour. So we actually have good experience from people requiring intubation in a short period of time, which is very similar to sedation in a short period of time. And so I really, you know, we stopped, like, this was getting crazy a few, like Aaron said, maybe 10 years ago. And one of the things is, you know, it's like, well, you're going to aspirate. So one of the practices I've been doing for a while is I just sit just about every sedation up, mm-hmm. you know, along as, because why wouldn't I? It's better respiratory status and any passive movement of food or fluid. I'm going to decrease that possibility. You know, that may be all voodoo, but I think most people don't vomit or aspirate as much when they're sitting up as when they lay down.
I got to stop putting all my sedated patients in reverse Trendelenburg. That may explain a lot.
Well, those inversion chairs, I do it for the back pain. So you come with a little back pain, I put you in an inversion chair, give you propofol, let you wake up, send home. It's a great back pain cure.
No. Don't do that.
I'm very sarcastic.
Oh my gosh, all the turkeys that will have to happen to make sure nobody does that. So the other thing that came up from this ACEP clinical policy was use capnography. They said capnography is great. It's another modality that you can use to monitor your patient. The risks of a lot of these sedative agents that we'll get into in a bit are going to be apnea and hypotension. That's pretty common among almost all anesthetics that we're going to use. So if you want to look for apnea early, you can find it earlier on capnography. So end-tidal CO2 monitoring plus pulse oximetry plus an ECG, three-lead ECG tracing on a monitor, and that will give you a really good look, plus some intermittent blood pressures, usually every couple of minutes or something, to make sure that they're not going hypotensive on you. So when I'm training residents to do their first sedation, I look up on the monitor and I go, all right, what's that one? That's the end-tidal CO2. All right, that's the only thing I want you to really look at, because when that drops, then you need to start doing something. The next one I want you to look at is this one, the pulse ox, because that will be the second thing to drop. And when the pulse ox starts to drop, you better be doing a whole lot more. And the third thing I want you to look at is the heart rate, because once the heart rate starts to drop, that's the last thing to drop, and then we've got a cardiac arrest. So the end tidal falls off first, and then your pulse ox falls off, and then your heart rate slows down, and you finally, all the lines become nice and straight. We want to avoid that at all costs. But capnography helps give me warm fuzzies when I'm doing a sedation to know that my patient is taking breaths.
It, and to be honest, I practiced before capnography and during. Initially I was like, oh, everyone's got to do this, and it was kind of interesting and exciting. I don't know. It hasn't really changed much of what I've done in a lot of this, and partly because before, we would have the pulse ox on, and yes, capnography helps with maybe some early detection, but it also it didn't always work. Partly because sometimes you give people sedation, their mouth's open and their mouth reading, and we put these nasal prongs in, and you're like, what's it reading? 10? Is it even reading? I don't know. And so then you're like, well, I can't really go with that because I see their chest rise and fall, and they've been breathing, they're sitting there like in their ketamine state looking at me, and I'm like, well, you're moving and your oxygen's good and we're not giving any oxygen, so okay, maybe it doesn't help. So I think with each of these, you should realize what are some of the downfalls. So that's a downfall with capnography that you just need to be aware of. Now, the other thing is, with sedations, we talk about whether we should, give oxygen to these patients. A lot of these patients, I actually just put them on some oxygen for it. And you can say, well, you're pre-oxygenating. Yeah, we find that pre-oxygenating intubation works well. It works well for sedation too, especially if you're doing 5 or 10 minutes. If I give you a bunch of oxygen, if you stop breathing for a little bit, slow your respiratory rate down, or just intermittently breathe, and then you're going to wake up, like with the propofol, maybe that's okay. Like, I'm not really harming you. We're not worried about a transient hypercarbia that then resolves. What we're really worried about is a hypoxemic episode that's knocking off some nerve brain cells. And that's why what Aaron's talking about is it's using it as an earlier detection device before the pulse ox and everything goes down.
Yeah, because before using capnography, I was taught never put these patients on oxygen. Because if you put them on oxygen and they're sat as 100% on oxygen and then you make them apneic, by the time you recognize that they're apneic, because they start to become hypoxic, they're now hypoxic on supplemental oxygen. So if you've got somebody on a non-rebreather during their sedation and you make them go apneic, it's going to take a while for them to have been apneic until they go hypoxic. And then you have less things to do in order to intervene for that hypoxia. You basically got to go straight to bag mask ventilation and an intubation in order to correct that, because you've already done all the other stuff. So I was originally told, don't ever do that because you want to see the moment they start to go hypoxic. Now that you have end-tidal CO2, you can do exactly what Brian's saying. You take the same nasal cannula, put a little bit of oxygen through it to prevent even brief periods of apnea from causing any hypoxemia, but you'll recognize the apnea before they really are apneic for 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, and then the oxygen starts to drop on their pulse ox.
Yeah. And there's, with a lot of this, with our agents now, because we're doing a lot of shorter sedations than we had with the longer agents, that's part of it too, I think, is because before, if you put them on oxygen and they stopped breathing, they were apneic on fentanyl Versed, that apnea is a 30-minute apnea if you gave it a good enough dose. As opposed to, be honest, if a propofol, if you go apneic from a single bolus, it's going to be out of your system in under 10 minutes probably. And that won't be the cause of the apnea at that point. So it's one of these interesting, as we've evolved, like they're not all evolving at the same time. And some of our thoughts or theories may not be correlating with how our current practice is. So it's interesting how all this sedation stuff is truly evolving to what we should or shouldn't be doing. And there was some recent studies that even looked at maybe capnography, if you didn't have it or it doesn't prevent any harms to patients. Again, it's a reasonable adjunct to have. I'm not saying get rid of it, but just know because you don't have it, it doesn't mean like, because some places it was hard to find, right? You couldn't do capnography, or I don't have the module to put in my monitor in some hospitals, or I have to buy a separate device, so it was limiting. I think now it's become more standard over the last 10 years, but still sometimes, you know, it may not be available to you. It doesn't mean you can't do a sedation. You just need to know if you don't have it, these are other things that you should look for. And so those of us trained before, we would look for breathing. We'd look at the patient more often than people who just put their head down and don't even look at the patient for sedation.
Start doing their Sudoku.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, looking for chest rise is so key with this. You can pick that up pretty quickly if you don't have the patient's chest covered and you can actually see what's going on. So I would definitely recommend that if you don't have capnography. I even still look for that when I'm in a room.
Yeah, so. And depending on what you've got, maybe all of a sudden your end title, you know, isn't as good anymore because the patient's trying to lick it.
Or it fell out.
Or your pulse ox goes down because the blood pressure cuff goes off. Mm-hmm. Well, look at the patient and watch them take breaths like we used to do before we had all this technology and feel better about yourself until all of your technology is restored.
And the pulse ox could fall off.
Yeah.
You have to check all this stuff.
It's like when you suddenly get one bar on your cell phone. You're like, oh my gosh, how am I ever going to survive? Oh, good, good. All right, I'm back. You just need to be able to make it through it. So one of the other recommendations from the ASEP clinical policy was to have at least two people, to have the physician who is giving the sedation / doing the procedure, and one person, a nurse or someone who's otherwise trained, to focus solely on the patient. And this makes sense of that you want someone, if you're going to be focused in on doing a procedure, then you're focused on the procedure. There is a surgeon and an anesthesiologist for a reason. You need somebody focused on the procedure and somebody focused on the sedation. So we often have our nurses that we pull out, and they have to do a lot of checklists, and they have to do a lot of paperwork, and they need things signed, and they do all this. And this is no slight to the nurses, because they don't write this paperwork. But it's frustrating. You just want to get it done. Mm-hmm. You're just like, why do I have to do all this paperwork? Why do I have to say their Mallampati score? I'm not going to intubate them. Why do I need to sign all these things? Why? Well, it's because it's a safeguard. We get frustrated because it takes a nurse out of their zone until the patient fully awakens. We often, if there's a, we're down nurses, we don't have a nurse to do this sedation, and we're going to have to wait, and we're going to have to time it, and we want it done now. So we try to cut corners, right, Chris?
Oh, this drives me crazy. So in the last few years, I've seen a huge trend towards trying to dose ketamine to treat the pain that we're going to cause from this procedure, and basically giving, you know, fairly high aggressive doses of pain dose ketamine to maybe kind of dissociate the patient enough that you can do the procedure without calling it a procedural sedation. But again, going back to what we talked about early on in this podcast, it's all about the intent. So if your intent is to get that patient into a dissociated state or make it so they don't care that you're doing a procedure to them, that becomes a moderate to deep sedation. And it doesn't matter if you say that it's for pain control or not. By doing that, we circumvent all the safety measures that allow us to do this safely. If you don't have a nurse in there monitoring during the procedure, you're losing that two-person two people monitoring safety check that ASEP recommends. If you aren't putting capnography in place, you're losing some of your, you know, really good monitoring tools to make sure that you're doing it safely. Again, by circumventing all of these safety measures, we're creating a less safe environment for the patient, and I really don't think we're doing them any favors. So if your goal is that moderate to deep sedation, treat it like a procedural sedation. It's a pain in the butt and it's annoying, but all those annoying pain in the butt features are there for a reason.
I can't believe people are doing that. That's just crazy. I mean, to be honest, and I get the frustration with waiting. If you want this procedure to happen, you go sit in the room and you take your time and you say, yep, I'm ready to go. Let me know when everything's ready. Nothing gets something done until the physician sits in the room and is waiting. You want to get things happening? If you disappear and go off to see other patients, they're not going to get that procedural sedation done quickly. Mm-hmm. Go sit in the room, like, do you want me to go pull up this? I'll go pull up the med. That can motivate and get people done. And there's no reason
it doesn't have to be a long setup. Maybe 10, 15 minutes to get everything set up.
Depends on what you use and how long your patient's out for.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you may be done in 15 minutes, or it may be like a 30, you know, to 60 minute total from prep to done. And you're not, you know, saving yourself to do this, but people are, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. I just haven't seen that. That's just insane.
Crazy. Drives me nuts.
So I'll make note of, along with what Chris said, when we do billing, for those of you that are no longer residents, our billing for procedural sedation does not start until we have had continuous face-to-face time with the patient for 16 minutes.
Hmm.
Okay. Now that's a weird little quirk, but I will comment for any of you that are out there in private practice or about to, you know, graduate and go off and work on your own. If you are going to charge the patient or the insurance company for a procedural sedation and you try to shortcut some of these mechanisms, I would be very cautious in doing that, because part of what is bundled into what we charge for all this is the fact that we have a nurse who's taken out of their zone to be able to do these sedations and to provide all these extra equipments. So if you're not going to provide all the fail safes for a sedation, I would not bill for a sedation. But that's my own personal opinion.
In terms of the two people as well, as residents, you may get a different feel for kind of how the community does it too. I just want to give a couple of perspectives. So if you're, say, in the community, the nurses in most places, because there's only a single physician there, will be able to push your drugs, pull your drugs, and do a lot of it. Because a lot of places don't have an ED pharmacist and they don't have lots of people. They will be your monitor, but you tell them the dose, you guys verify it together, but they're in charge of pushing that medicine or running that drip. That way you are the one doing the procedure, because it's usually you doing the procedure. Now, maybe, you know, you're going to do the sedation and you had a consultant or someone else come in to do that procedure. That's, in those cases, yes, you may push the medications yourself. As opposed, sometimes in residency, like here, nurses can't push a lot of this sedation. So the residents, you know, you guys are getting good experience in doing that, and the ED pharmacist pulling up the medicines. So, and you may have seven people and you have like three different resident consultants in the room and everyone's doing the procedure. So just know it can range. This is a whole spectrum for these sedations. When they say two people, yes, you need two people. One, it may just be a doctor nurse. And in that case, the doctor should probably do the procedure and the nurse should probably do the monitoring. Mm-hmm. But it could be a lot of people, but it could be any combination. You could have just Absolutely. A doctor doing the monitoring, as in the case for anesthesia. They're the ones doing all the checklists. And if you invite them down, maybe you're like, hey, I can reduce this forum, but I need you to do the sedation for me. That may be the case. So just know that there's a spectrum, but do have at least two people.
Definitely. And a lot of it depends on your state laws as well. That's a really good point about nurses in Arizona specifically not being able to push certain drugs like propofol and higher doses of ketamine. Similarly, pharmacists have comparable restrictions from state to state, but there is some data out there having the pharmacist be the second person, the person who's administering the medications, monitoring, and then if something goes wrong, saying, I think we need to intubate this guy, and nudging their physician colleague and saying, hey, like, we really need to do something about this. That can be any mix, as you mentioned. Just a little plug for pharmacy.
And as you're doing it, if you're doing it yourself, you know, even though you're doing the procedure, as a physician, I feel that you should be looking at that patient intermittently during the procedure. Yeah, you're throwing in some sutures. You can pause. You can do a reduction. You can pause and look at their chest. You can look at the monitor.
Mm-hmm. As an emergency physician.
As an emergency physician, you should be doing that. Because if there is an intervention that needs to happen, you may need to break away and do a jaw thrust or manage that blood pressure. So just be wary if you're doing it by yourself. You can't dive in and focus on that complex lac repair for 20 minutes without looking at the patient.
Yeah, if you're an orthopedist, just do what you do best.
Yeah.
So I'll give you a quick synopsis of what I tell parents when I'm doing a sedation. And how I consent them, because keep in mind that we've got the majority of parents out there, on average, will have a fifth grade understanding of kind of medical practice and, you know, even reading level in some areas. And so you have to make sure that when you are consenting people, you are really doing your best to give them an informed consent. If they come back and say, I can't believe my patient or my kid ended up in the ICU, you didn't tell me something like this. Go, well, I told you they might be endotracheally intubated and end up on mechanical ventilation. But you didn't say that this might happen. I mean, you have to make sure that you are saying this in reasonable terms. And I also think that you don't need to unreasonably scare patients of like, you know, the potentials for this, maybe they get hypotensive, maybe they'll go apneic, they could require intubation and they could die. So you ready to fix little Susie's face, lip lack? So I think that you have to be reasonable. When I hear medical doctors consent, they're fairly optimistic of like, hey, you need to know these things will happen, but we feel pretty good about it. When I hear surgeons consent, they are doom and gloom. They are like, this could lead to loss of life, loss of limb, loss of function. It's like, golly. But when you're a surgeon, you disappear into the OR and you don't really know what you're going to find, and you have to have said all of these things before you come back and like, hey, forgot to mention, this could lead to loss of limb because I found something in there and it's not my fault though, but yeah, I forgot to mention that. Like, you have to do those things early. And I think to some degree we do that as well. But we try not to scare people because we need to get this done. So I let them know, I'll take the ketamine fracture reduction, which is my standard. So we need to take little Johnny's fracture. We need to straighten out his arm. It can't stay like this. And that's painful. So we want to make sure that he's not going to remember what's going on. We're going to do our best to put him in a dreamlike state so that he can have happy thoughts instead of what's going on now. What I typically will do is use a medicine called ketamine. Ketamine's a great drug. I like ketamine because it provides the three things that I want for patients. They won't feel what, it's got some pain control properties. They won't remember what's going on, and they generally are out and don't interact as much. Anytime we give a sedative medicine, it has effects on their breathing and on their blood pressure. It may make their breathing slower or even stop, and it makes their blood pressure low, but ketamine has the least amount of those effects and in fact kind of goes the opposite way. So we know that it's very safe. In order to make sure those things don't happen, we put your child on a monitor. We watch their heart rate, we watch their breathing, we watch their oxygen, and we have a nurse who is dedicated to just watching your child while we get this procedure done. With ketamine, if you've ever had a kid sleepwalk or talk in their sleep before, they can kind of do that with ketamine, of where maybe they'll respond, maybe they'll move, but it won't be like if I walked over and grabbed his arm now, where he would be punching, biting, clawing, kicking, and really angry at me. They may respond like, and you know the lights are on, but nobody's home. So that's how we know this is going to work. Plus, with ketamine, the eyes will twitch back and forth. So we really know that they're under. We give them the drug. Usually within about 10, 15 seconds, they are in a happier place. And when they wake up, most kids wake up really goofy, like on the YouTube videos. But every once in a while, kids have a bad dream. And if they have a bad dream, we have some medicine that can help smooth this out. But I want you to be here and do what you would do for them if they had a bad dream at home. And that's my consent for a ketamine sedation, which encompasses all the stuff that we talked about and sounds reasonable that anybody would understand what the risks and benefits are. Do you have any questions about this? Great. Let's go. So the last thing that's not on the ASEP guidelines is a timeout. We do timeouts all the time. I think everybody's timeout is a little bit different, though. But we say, this is so-and-so, their date of birth, their medical record number, their blood type, their where they went to kindergarten, and we're doing such-and-such sedation for this arm. We have a consent signed, and we got everything. Okay, let's go. Like, it's not as structured as I think it is when they do anesthesia and they've got, you know, standardized things that they're doing, because usually the things that we're doing are kind of with a different group every single time. But a timeout is incredibly important as one of the checklist things that you can have to make sure that you don't miss anything, that you don't suddenly turn around and go, hey, where is that bag valve mask? We kind of need that right now, and it's not in the room to look and say, oh, wait, the oxygen's not actually hooked up and it's not working. The tank is empty. We don't have fluids in the room. All the things that you want to have, make your own checklist or see what checklist your hospital has to make sure that you don't miss out on some of these things.
Yeah, I think the timeout, one of the things that I like to do is actually say the drug, the patient's weight, and my planned dosing, just so nursing, myself, everyone's on the same page, and we kind of know what we're going to draw up, because that's, of all the things that I think probably are important in the timeout is, well, I was going to push 3 mLs. Well, no, you wanted to push 10 mLs. No, oh, wait, I wanted to push 0.5 mLs. Right, that's usually the most common catch-up that I see, and like, oh, that's right. Yeah. This is the real dose that we want.
Yeah.
To do.
Did you just give 3 syringes? Yeah. Give 30 mLs. No. 30 milligrams.
Right.
Like, ooh, that was 3 mLs. Uh-oh.
Do we have fluids in the room?
And the rest of the stuff, if you're prepping for, you know, sedation prepping, once you start to get it down, goes pretty fast. You know, it's your airway equipment, it's fluids and monitoring. And yep, those are the major things that you need, and then having the drugs. So if you have that, I really like Darren's consent, just, you know, breaking it down very basically. In those situations, what I use is I tell the parents, we're going to put your kid in a la-la land. Their body's here and their brain's going to be outside the room looking at their body. And they're just going to be separate. But they're going to go and do, and preparing people for what's going to happen is huge as part of your consent. Knowing that they may stare off, knowing that their eyes may move, knowing that they may moan, you know, knowing that someone, like giving propofol, they may breathe slower or they may even stop breathing. And we may have to bag you, but it's not a, you know, we're just giving you a breath or two while that medicine starts to wear off. As Aaron's saying, you're telling them the risks in a very basic thing and your plans to correct said risks and harms so that they are prepared. And that way, when someone's like, oh, why are they intubated? You kind of, you know, hey, we may have to put a breathing tube in your throat, but once the medicine's off, we could pull it out.
I think I've only really had 2 bag valve mask ventilations that I've ever had to do in a sedation in 10 years. And one of them was a little old lady that we couldn't get her shoulder back in, and she was a little frail, and we kept trying to push propofol, and we were like, nope, we stopped. We weren't successful because she went apneic, and we had to bag her. And the other was a kid that got a slug of medicine too quickly, and we had to bag the kid. And I was able to turn to the family and said, so, as we discussed, sometimes if they get a little bit too much medicine on board, they can have trouble breathing, so we're just helping out. And the family smiled at me and said, okay, great. Inside, I'm, you know, shaking with fear behind my smile because this shouldn't happen. But we consented them, and the kid did fine and still ended up going home.
And these are the things that we're trained in, we know about. So this isn't like we're in a foreign situation. Well, what happens if the patient's breathing slows down? You know, as Chris is alluding to earlier, you know, patients have different responses. Even though I agree that the ranges for the drugs that we use now, their responses are pretty similar, but everyone still could be a little more sensitive, mm-hmm. or maybe they're not sensitive and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm pushing so much, and then it catches up and you're like, oh gosh, maybe I shouldn't have done that much. But these are, you know, these are the things we, in a sense, we've prepared for. I agree with Aaron. I've never, knock on wood, intubated a patient from a sedation. I've never had to do that. I think I have bagged a couple people, and I'll tell you the things that I ran into, and we may get into this later, is I gave opiates after propofol. Mm. I think that is something you should never do. Because it was like, oh, we got some, you know, propofol. We probably need a little more pain control. Wrong answer. So learn from my mistakes. And that was just, we bagged them for a little bit, and then the propofol wore off, and we were fine. But that's one of those mistakes that we'll talk about. Opiates before any of these is my take.
Definitely. Just a couple quick notes on kind of managing expectations for, I would say, not only the parents of a kid, but also even a kid or an adult who's receiving ketamine. I always try to warn them that we're about to give them something that could make them hallucinate. So they're not having surprise hallucinations, right? So with kids, I usually try to tell them, ask them about their favorite cartoon, tell me about it. It kind of helps put them in a headspace so that if they do start to have that weird dream state, it's at least a happy dream and not a terrifying dream that they're in a hospital getting their leg it's broken, manipulated. Exactly. And I do the same thing with adults. I just, you know, tell them, hey, we're going to give you a drug. It's going to make you feel weird. But try to know that you're safe, know that you're in a controlled environment. We're watching you. Try to think about something good. And then if I think it's reasonable, I'll ask, you know, have you taken a vacation recently? Or, you know, tell me about your favorite place. Or again, just to kind of, again, put them in their happy place so that when you, so you're not surprising them with a hallucinogenic drug.
And tell them to go with it too.
Yeah.
And I tell them, like, this may be trippy, just go with it. Like, wherever it takes you, go.
Absolutely. And then, just to give you the pharmacist perspective on the checklist. So the things that I'm looking for when I walk into a room, as you mentioned, I want to make sure that there's fluids hanging and running. I want to make sure that we've got more than enough drug in the room. So I'll usually have, you know, if it's propofol for an adult patient, I'll have two of those 10 mil vials just because I don't want to run out of drug halfway through the procedure. I also try to make sure that we have an RSI kit in the room. I've never needed it, but I always bring one. I've seen two patients get bagged. One was laryngospasm from ketamine, and one was a very old patient who maybe we shouldn't have given as much propofol to as we did, that needed a couple breaths but turned right around. The other thing that I look for is flushes. I like to have a lot of flushes out and ready to go. And then all the other stuff that you guys are looking for. Hopefully you're doing it, because I'm not really looking for anything but that.
So one of the times that I saw ketamine given, the patient was starting to get a little amped up. And what I generally will tell the patients is, like, look, if you go down happy, you'll wake up happy. If you go down scared, you're going to wake up scared. Mm-hmm. And so the attending, I was a resident at the time, and the attending who was with me, I'll let you guess who it was sitting in the back of the corner, and the patient's starting to freak out. And he goes, better calm down, bro. You're going to have a bad trip.
I could take a guess. That is awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty great.